It's 6 hours, Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa, coming up after these latest world news headlines.
Libya's new government meets as violence in Benghazi takes at least 20 lives. Nigerian authorities ban rallies demanding the safe return of those abducted schoolgirls. I'm Victor Beatty reporting from Washington. Libya's new Prime Minister, Ahmed Maitik, held his first official cabinet meeting Monday in Tripoli after police helped him take over the office his predecessor had refused to give up. The North African country has been embroiled in months of violence and political turmoil. Outgoing Prime Minister Abdullah El Thani had refused to hand over power. The new Prime Minister, the nation's fifth since 2011, denounced fighting between Islamist militants and a renegade general that has left at least 20 dead in the city of Benghazi. Libya has failed to unite since autocrat Muammar Gaddafi was ousted 2.5 years ago. It remains divided by regional loyalties, countless militia, and increased terrorism. The World Health Organization reports cholera is spreading rapidly in South Sudan's capital city, Juba, with more than 1,000 cases and at least 27 fatalities reported since April 23rd. Lisa Schlein reports.
A WHO specialist in cholera, Dr. Dominique Legros, says the unsanitary conditions of the displaced persons camps and the onset of the rainy season are expected to accelerate the spread of this often fatal disease.
We have to be ready for situation of a large epidemic, if you want to call it an epidemic, in the country. We know that they go very fast, and we have seen this again this time in Juba.
Legault says controlling the outbreak in more remote areas will be complicated during the rainy season as roads become impassable, cutting off access. He says this period usually provokes an upsurge in cholera cases due to flooding that contaminates water sources. Cholera spreads through contaminated food and water. It causes severe vomiting and acute diarrhea, which can lead to dehydration. It can kill within hours if left untreated, but most cases are successfully treated with oral rehydration salts. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Police in Nigeria have banned protests in the capital Abuja, demanding that the government rescue more than 200 schoolgirls kidnapped by Islamist militia. Officials cite security reasons. They say the protests could be hijacked by what they call dangerous elements. Demonstrators denounced the move, vowing to challenge the ban in court. Protests have been taking place almost daily, part of a campaign to keep attention on the kidnappings and pressure the government to rescue the girls. Among those who've taken part, Wasila Mohammed of Abuja.
I think of the girls and I think it could have been me. It could be my daughter. It could be my niece. You know, it could be anybody. And it's, just think of, I think of the mothers and I think, you know what, we have to do this. We have to, someone has to do it. So if we don't do it, right, then who else? They're voiceless. These people in Chibok are voiceless until now that we have stood, that we are the voices of Chibok.
Rotima Olawale is media coordinator for the Bring Back Our Girls campaign.
Today is day 49, and if the girls are not rescued at the end of today, tomorrow we'll make it day 50, that over 200 girls have been kidnapped from Chibok. I feel like a Chibok parent, and I'm very depressed to know that we do not know the condition that they are. From newspaper reports, several of Nigerian newspaper quoting the Daily Mail on Sunday, reported that one of the girls have a broken wrist and a number of them are healed. So we currently feel for the condition that they are right now, and we are hoping that there will be a miracle and that the girls will be rescued as soon as possible.
The girls were kidnapped in mid-April while taking part in exams at a secondary school in Borno State. That state's governor, Kashim Shettima, says nearly 60 of the girls who escaped captivity will be relocated to schools in Lagos and Abuja, where they will take final classes and another exam. New Malawian President Peter Mutharika was inaugurated Monday after an election disputed by his predecessor. He told supporters at a Blantyre Stadium he wanted to reconcile with former President Joyce Banda, whose demand for a new election was rejected by the nation's high court. The 74-year-old Mutharika, brother of the late President Bingu Wa Mutharika, whose death in 2012 allowed Ms. Banda to ascend from vice president. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, June 3rd. And here are some of the stories we are covering. Nigerian police ban Bring Back Our Girls protest in the capital, Abuja.
The police is not banning this protest out of bad faith. We have reports that some Muslims are trying to hijack the good thing these people are doing. And that is why we said, for now, let's have a stop on this protest.
Attorney Daniel is the spokeswoman for the Nigerian Federal Capital Territory Police. The governor of Borno State, hot bail for Boko Haram, vows to fight the Islamist militants. Civil society groups say they are disappointed by former Malawi President Joyce Banda's refusal to peacefully hand over power. And South Sudan's president promises to restore peace to his war-torn country.
I am for peace and will always be for peace. I'm also for the development and progress of this nation, but will never stand for its destruction.
The South Sudan President Salva Kiir, and can Egypt's new president heal the country's economic woes? We'll get analysis. Those stories plus Mark Oldman's sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Police in Nigeria have banned the daily protests in the capital, Abuja, intended to focus attention on the more than 200 schoolgirls kidnapped by Islamist militants and pressure the government to rescue the girls. The demonstrators have vowed to challenge the ban in court. Attorney Daniel, spokeswoman for the Nigeria Federal Capital Territory Police, says the police did not ban the protests out of bad faith. But, she tells me, authorities have received intelligence that hooligans bent on causing trouble have been trying to hijack the protests.
First and foremost, I would like to say that the police and FCT Police Command have supported the protesters from day one, and we've always been with them throughout the period. But the police, in its wisdom, is not banning this protest out of bad faith. But because of an incident we had last week, where another group by the name Elisa Girl started pitching his tent to at the Unity Fountain, and there was almost a bloody clash there. That is one. Two, we have reports that some Muslims are trying to hijack the good thing these people are doing to bring about problems, and we are looking at it from all the angles the normal security agent is supposed to look at it. And that is why we said, for now, let's have a stop on this protest, so that we can be able to monitor the activities of these hoodlums who would like to come and take over the process which is being done in good light to foment trouble or bring about a crisis within the federal capital territory.
So what sort of reports do you have? What kind of people?
But you should know, a security report is a security report. It's not a report for everybody's consumption. It's just for the security agents who get this report to make good use of it. And that is why we're trying to forestall the breakdown of law and order based on our own report.
What do you say to those who say that perhaps the police are stopping the protesters because the protesters are trying to put pressure on the government to work a little harder to find the girls?
I want you to know that the federal government have been doing its very best. Security agents and agencies have not relented in their efforts at making sure we curb the excesses of these hoodlums and bring back this job. So for anybody to say we are being used by government, I think that person is not being fair to us, because from day one, we've supported them and we've always been with them. But because of the security reasons, that is why we are trying to forestall a breakdown of law and order.
Can these protests take place in other cities besides Abuja?
Well, for now, what we have in our report is within Abuja, and we are the police command here in Abuja. And whatever actions we are taking it in the interest of the overall good of the citizens residing within the federal capital territory.
So the ban is effective as of what day?
Today is the day the pronouncement was made, and I can assure you we agreed it in good faith, and from today becomes effective.
Attorney Daniel is the spokeswoman for the Nigeria Federal Capital Territory Police. She was speaking with me from the capital, Abuja. The violent Islamic sect Boko Haram continues on its deadly path in northern Nigeria, holding more than 200 schoolgirls hostage and staging deadly attacks on cities and villages. The governor of the northeastern Nigerian state of Borno says the toll on his state is high in terms of human lives and economic development, but he says he's determined to fight what he calls madmen terrifying the region. Zlatika Hoke has more.
Protests are held daily in Nigeria's capital, Abuja, where activists say they want more government action to free the girls from the clutches of Boko Haram.
I think of the girls and I think it could have been me. It could be my daughter. It could be my niece. It could be anybody. I think of the mothers and I think, you know what, we have to do this. Someone has to do it.
Borno governor Kashim Shettima describes Boko Haram's leader, Abubakar Shekau, as insane.
I see him as a madman. In this age and time, somebody is talking of selling the girls into slavery. Can a reasonable, sensible person talk along that line? To me, he's a madman.
Shettima says he is determined to stop the terror caused by the marauding militants over the past 5 years. In the latest attack Sunday, a bomb believed to be planted by Boko Haram killed about 40 football fans in neighboring Adamawa state. Shettima says the group of about 1,500 fanatics is holding communities in the entire region ransom.
But I can assure you that they are not as many as people who I met out to believe. But because they are setting the pace of the war, they can wreak a lot of havoc. And that is precisely what they are doing. And they are not adhering to any international convention. They are just a bunch of raving lunatics.
The Borno governor says terror and violence has had a devastating impact on the state's economy. He says his state, which borders Niger, Chad, and Cameroon, is uniquely positioned for trade and investment. But the fighting has all but halted the development of the necessary infrastructure, especially the roads. He says the borders are closing and it will take time to repair Borno's image abroad.
It's very painful because Borno has been in the news for the wrong reasons for the past 5 years. Borno is the cradle of Islamic civilization in the West African sub-region. We have 1,200 years of recorded history. It's an insult to the integrity, the history of the people of Borno.
The United States has sent military experts to help track more than 200 Nigerian girls still held by the Boko Haram militant group. Zlatica Hoke, VOA News, Washington.
South Sudan President Salva Kiir has again promised to restore peace to his war-torn country. Addressing the opening session of the National Assembly on Monday, President Kiir said his priorities for the country include improving food security and rebuilding towns and villages destroyed by the ongoing conflict. Charlton Doki of VOA South Sudan in Focus program has more from Juba.
A police band played at the opening of the 2014 National Assembly moments before President Kiir stepped to the podium. President Kiir decried the violence that has left thousands of people dead. He accused anti-government forces allied to former Vice President Riek Machar of violating the cessation of hostilities agreement signed in Addis Ababa last month.
I am for peace and will always be for peace, but not war. I'm also for the development and progress of this nation, but will never stand for its destruction. I promise to work with you to see South Sudan emerge strong economically and politically.
Mr. Kiir reiterated his commitment to unite South Sudanese. He called on the country's diverse communities to reconcile with one another and move forward as a united nation.
I humbly appeal to you all, my dear citizens, including our brothers and sisters who are now in opposition, to forgive one another and come together in the spirit of true reconciliation and join hands to work in unity and understanding.
Mr. Kiir says he hopes to reach a political agreement and permanent ceasefire with the rebels and form an interim government in the coming months. He lashed out at unnamed leaders who he says are jostling for positions in a proposed interim government. The president used his recently signed peace deal with Jonglei State's Pibor County rebel leader, David Yauyau, to show that he can achieve peace in South Sudan. He urged legislators to endorse the agreement with Yauyau as soon as possible. Mr. Kiir says he will rebuild the country and pointed to plans to start in December the long-awaited construction of the Fula Rapids Hydro Project through a private-public partnership. For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Juba.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, June 3rd. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 16 minutes past the hour. A group of civil society and non-governmental organizations have expressed disappointment over former President Joyce Banda's refusal to hand over power peacefully to newly installed President Peter Mutharika. Billy Mayaya, a leading member of the Malawi Civil Society Group, tells reporter Peter Clotty that the former president's action shows a lack of leadership.
Yes, I think we're concerned because I think the inauguration process is filled with symbolism. And one of the symbols is one of, you know, showing commitment to nation building. Now, her refusal sent the wrong signals to various stakeholders in that she was maybe bitter with her loss. And I think that doesn't augur well with an emergent democracy like Malawi.
But what do you say to people and legal experts who said she was not constitutionally mandated to officially hand over power, so she's not legally bound to be present?
That may be true, but I think people are more placing a stress on symbolisms, you know, the symbols of handing over democratically to a successor. And I think lack of those symbolisms is a source of concern to civil society because it sends the wrong signals in terms of nation building.
Billy Mayaya is a leading member of civil society groups in Malawi. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from the commercial capital Blantyre. The Malawi Law Society says former President Banda could not be legally compelled to hand over power to the newly elected leader Peter Mutharika. Salisa Kalimba, spokesperson for the group, tells reporter Peter Clotty that Mrs. Banda was within her right not to show up at Mutharika's inauguration.
Well, first, let me just say, of course, legally, she was not obliged to go there and do any handovers. But, however, symbolically, it would have been very good for the country, for her just, you know, to go as a good gesture. I know, go and wish Professor Mutharika all the best and ceremoniously, you know, hand over. But I think it would have symbolized quite a lot to the country, you know, to have showed unity. Showed Alisa she has accepted this and is willing to move forward. But as I've said, she has done nothing wrong legally, so we can't really force her to do it.
Salisa Kalimba is the spokesperson for Malawi's Law Society. She spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from the capital, Lilongwe. During his campaign, Egypt's president-elect Abdel Fattah el-Sisi promised to heal the nation's ailing economy. And while many Egyptians have high hopes for newfound safety and prosperity, Mr. Sisi has called on Egyptians to make sacrifices, and he warned it will take years to reform the economy. But after 3 years of upheaval and no clear economic program, how much sacrifice can Egyptians make? Heather Murdoch has more for VOA from Cairo.
Once popular with tourists, this market has mostly local shoppers a few days after the presidential election. Abdel Fattah el-Sisi has been declared the winner. Pre-election pro-Sisi music still blares on the streets. Locals say the tourism industry, like others in Egypt, has flatlined. Ahmed Allah makes traditional boxes and games out of wood and mother of pearl. He says business has been bad since the 2011 revolution.
So actually before the revolution, we was working very much and it was a lot, it was many tourists in Egypt. But after the revolution, we feel very, very bad because the economy in Egypt, it's not only the tourists. Everything is damaged and everything's fall down.
Mr. Sisi's ideas to improve the economy were already in play before the votes were counted. The government plans to cut subsidies and reduce the national deficit. Mohammed Gad is a senior economic reporter at El Sharouk, a prominent Egyptian newspaper. He says the plan could backfire, and a large cut in fuel subsidies could cause more unrest.
To some degree, this is an unprecedented move by the Egyptian state to deal with the subsidy. Without having a clear vision and alternative policies that would ease the economic pressure on both people in dire poverty and the middle class, it could bring down the social system.
Despite widespread poverty, the incoming president has called for sacrifices from the Egyptian people, suggesting they eat less food, walk more, and use less electricity to help their economy recover. He says he will significantly improve the economy and the security situation within 2 years. But activists say the Egyptian public will not wait 2 years for change. Heather Murdoch for VOA News, Cairo.
Burkina Faso and five other African countries will soon be receiving off-grid energy solutions as part of a new initiative from the Islamic Development Bank. During a conference in Dakar on Tuesday, the bank announced its Renewable Energy for Poverty Reduction Plan, which it says aims to raise around $175 million to provide solutions to such as mini-grids. Shamusa Rema Tour, a leader of the initiative, tells Ricky Schreier the mini-grids will mix solar and diesel power to help off-grid communities gain access to electricity and alleviate poverty.
Well, on Tuesday, basically, we are launching this new flagship initiative of the Islamic Solidarity Fund for Development, which is the poverty reduction arm of the bank. And this program basically will bring electricity to the remote off-grid communities. By installing small mini-grids, which will be essentially a hybrid of solar and diesel power generators. Essentially, the main source of electricity will be solar energy, but it will be backed up by diesel because in the night you don't have solar. And in case of emergency, you will have to have some backup in form of diesel generators.
In the next 3 years, the program will be implemented in 6 countries. Could you tell me which 6 countries they are?
Well, as a matter of fact, we have already starting, our technical teams have already visited Burkina Faso, which is the first country to benefit from the program. Now, as far as the other 5 countries are concerned, we have a lot of interest from the member countries, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa. So as part of this conference, we are organizing an investment forum in which we are inviting proposals from a number of member countries. Actually, it's open to all member countries to come up with proposals of projects that they would want the bank to finance. So those 5 countries are not firmed up yet.
What are some of the more precise ways access to energy can help alleviate poverty?
As a matter of fact, you see, in these remote off-grid communities, people don't have access to electricity. B, if they do have access to electricity, the means of producing that electricity are very expensive. People primarily rely on diesel generators. And the cost of diesel is extremely high in landlocked countries, in countries. Second of all, when people have access to electricity, they can use it for productive activities. And these productive activities, like small cottage industry shops, for example, storage of vaccines, the availability of electricity in the health clinics overnight in community centers, actually is useful for the community. But our focus is essentially bringing it to the people for productive purposes, for productive activities.
That was Shamusa Rema Tour, a senior portfolio management specialist at the Islamist Development Bank. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Dakar. This month, fans from around the world will be heading to Brazil for football's FIFA World Cup. But as health reporter Art Times tells us, public health experts advise there could be more at risk than a disappointing result on the field.
Experts at the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention say travelers visiting Brazil may be exposed to a variety of health and safety risks. Dr. Joanna Gaines in the CDC's Geographic Medicine branch says there always are risks to health and safety while traveling, but she cautions that for those going to Brazil for the World Cup or the 2016 Olympics,
travelers who are attending special events like these may be at an increased risk.
In an online article published in the medical journal JAMA Internal Medicine, Gaines and her colleagues recommended vaccinations or preventive medicine for infectious diseases, including yellow fever and malaria. In other cases, travelers should be aware of steps they can take to avoid getting infected, for example, with dengue fever.
There's no medication or a vaccine to prevent it, so we really recommend that travelers are regularly using insect repellents, wearing long-sleeve clothing, wearing clothing that's been treated with insect repellent, and doing those types of active things that they can do to protect their health.
Travelers are urged to check with their doctor before going, says the article, and doctors should alert their patients to hazards ranging from bed bugs and sexually transmitted diseases to crime and traffic accidents. In their article, Dr. Gaines and her colleagues say travelers should see their healthcare practitioner at least a month before leaving, and seek immediate attention if they develop a fever during or after their trip to Brazil. This is Art Chimes reporting.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Marco Woman in Johannesburg, South Africa. Good Tuesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with football. Uganda's Victoria University pipped Sudan's El Ahly Shandi by a solitary goal in the semifinals at the Council of Eastern Central Africa Football Association's SECAFA Nile Basin Tournament in Khartoum, Sudan on Monday. Later, Kenya's AFC Leopards dismissed Burundi's Academie Chite 2-0 in the other semifinal. Elsewhere, hosts Germany and Cameroon play to a 2-2 draw in Mönchengladbach on Sunday. Today, Tuesday, African champions Nigeria encounter Greece in another FIFA World Cup build-up match in Chester Park, Philadelphia State, in the United States of America. Meanwhile, Egypt amassed 44 gold, 16 silver and 29 bronze medals to top the medal table at the conclusion of the Africa Youth Olympic Games in Gaborone, Botswana over the weekend. South Africa is second with 41 gold, 25 silver and 27 bronze medals. Nigeria placed third with 19 gold, 10 silver and 12 bronze medals. Algeria was fourth, followed by Ethiopia, Tunisia, Kenya, Botswana, Morocco, while Namibia placed 10th overall. Mauritius was 11th, followed by Madagascar, Cameroon, Libya, Seychelles, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Senegal, Zimbabwe, Mali, Uganda, Chad, while Angola, along with Sao Tome and Principe, shared the 22nd spot. Ghana is 23rd, followed by Ivory Coast, Republic of Congo, Zambia, Equatorial Guinea, Mozambique, Malawi, Tanzania, Gabon, Sierra Leone, as Burundi and Cape Verde Islands shared the 33rd spot. 54 countries competed in 21 sports disciplines. In several disciplines, the 10-day event was a qualifier for the World Youth Olympics in Nanjing, China, in August. Finally, in athletics, Kenyan Lucy Kabu Wangui clocked 15 minutes and 21 seconds to win the Freyhofer's 5-kilometer run for women in Albany, New York State, in the United States of America over the weekend. Ethiopians Mamitu Daska and Afera Godfey completed the medal podium appearance. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. Here's our listener mail for this Tuesday morning, June 3rd.
Good morning, Africa. My name is Sani Abdullah Isali from Tuo local government of Kaduna State, Nigeria. My fellow Nigerians, the time has come for us to do away with political differences, regionalism, religious intolerance, sectarianism, and the economic dichotomy to face our common enemy, insecurity in Nigeria, Africa, and around the world. We should not give chance to civil war. We should not give chance to political turmoil. Rather, let us get united and solve this social upheaval. Thank you very much.
We thank you, listener, for your comment, and please send your viewpoints to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. That's it for this Tuesday, June 30 edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Shryak, as well as sports editor Mark Ouma, along with our engineer Carl Sterling, I'm James Butt in Washington, hoping that today will be a very nice day for you. Stay tuned for International Edition.
Hello, I am Shaka Sali. Join me on Straight Talk Africa every Wednesday as we discuss topics of special interest to Africans, including politics, economic development, press freedom, health, social issues, and conflict resolution. Take your pick. Watch on television, log on to the internet, or listen right here on the radio.
VOA.
Hello, I'm Douglas Simpoga. Join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas on the topic at hand. So, please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.